Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Shavuot Tov. Good evening.
Good evening.
Shavuot
Tov. Would anybody like to ask a question?
I do.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if you get my question by text, but
I did.
Okay, I was reading at Parashat Shemini, and then there was a part that really called my attention about the wine preparation that says that any wine that had been touched or made by an idolater, it's defiled. So I know that we should buy our wines kosher. But how can we know who, if there is another person or a person that is an idolater that have touched that wine?
When you buy a kosher wine, do you buy pasteurized wine or not?
Well, I buy kosher wines at the kosher store.
Yeah.
In a bottle.
Oh. Yeah. But has it been pasteurized or not?
That I don't know.
Well,
Brandy.
The Zohar was written many, many years before the pasteurization process. And what does the pasteurization process do? It kills bacteria. Maybe viruses, but I'm not sure about that. But I know it kills bacteria. The verse in the Zohar was written many years before that process of pasteurization. So when a idolater, whatever that means, would handle wine, and the halakha says even see the wine, that negative energy of the idolater was affecting the wine, which meant that it activated the bacteria in the wine. But after the pasteurization process was developed and became aware, that concern is no longer valid because the bacteria isn't there to be activated. And if you look on the bottles, you will find whether it's pasteurized or not. Now, there are wines that are not pasteurized, and they are kosher. And then you might... But once they're in the bottle, the process that the rabbi verifies is that no idolater has been involved in that processing up until the bottle. Now, once you remove the cork and pour it into a glass, you're in control of that. So, if you're concerned about it, I recommend you buy pasteurized kosher wine.
And what do I see that is being pasteurized in the bottle?
Yes, it's on the label. Or if you're not sure, you can ask the merchant if that particular label or that particular wine bottle is pasteurized or not, and he should be able to tell you. But it's on the label.
Okay. I just want to have a bottle in my hand, and I don't see what it says that it is or not, but I know it says culture for Passover, at least this one.
So which mark, which texture is the kosher for Passover? Is it a circle? Is it OU? What is it?
It's a K and a circle.
Okay. Well, there are, on the internet, you can look up which rabbi that is, and you can call and ask that rabbi if that wine is pasteurized. But I'm sure that if you look more closely at every word on the label, you'll see where it says pasteurized or not. If it doesn't say it, then it hasn't been pasteurized. And as long as it's in the bottle, the rabbi is certifying that there's been no idolater that's been involved with its processing. But once you open the bottle, it's up to you.
Huh. Interesting. Once I open the bottle, it's up to me. My next question is related to, can you spread a little bit more the concept of an idolater?
Definition of an idolater is anybody who worships idols. Now, what does it mean to worship idols? In the Zohar, that concept is consciousness. If there is something physical that you are unable to let go of, to do without, that physical item becomes an idol to you. In effect, we're saying almost every human being in today's world is an idolater on one level or another. Can you give up money? Can you give up sunlight? The answer to both those questions for the majority of human beings would be no. I need money to pay for my food. But if you have certainty, you know that the money isn't what pays for the food. It's Hashem who provides the food for you. And the means of exchange with the other human being who's giving you that food is the way human beings account for it. But that food comes to you from Hashem. The sunlight comes to you from Hashem, not the sun. Now, most human beings are not able to make that transition. They perceive that the sun shines and therefore it's coming from the sun. And to that extent that they don't appreciate that it came from Hashem, it's an idol to them. Jasmine, are you still confused?
No, I'm clear now.
Do you have any other questions along these lines?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I don't.
Does anyone else have any questions?
Yes, I have one.
Okay, go ahead.
I wanted to ask about the when you say the Yana Bekoach, and you say the letters Yud Chav Shin, that they can take us to DNA level and restore and repair, and then come back. So, will that affect the physical body? And if it does, how long does that process take?
Let's start with what is actually said. Miriam, I think you're listening to the recordings where you got that. Because it's been a couple of weeks since I've said it. Because I usually do the meditations in the Anapakoa. I do that in the basic classes, and then as we progress into the advanced classes, people should know and make that transition themselves. But what I say is in the third verse, Nagi Bor Dorshe Yechudecha Kivavat Shamlein, or Shem Kivod Machuto Le'olam. So it's Nun Gimel Dalet Yud Kaf Shin are the six letters. And the first three letters, Nun Gimel Dalet, have a gematria of 57, which is the same as the Hebrew word Zan, Zion Nun, which means Parnasa or sustenance. And sustenance has the meaning of any desire or any lack, sustenance will fulfill any lack. Then Yud Kaf Shin, what is said, is this is a healing sequence, and that you can take any part of your body that needs healing back to its stem cell state, where it could be cleansed, where it can be healed, where it can be rejuvenated, and then return it to the body where it will again do its action that it was created to do perfectly. Now, nowhere in that process did I say anything about DNA. But in essence, I am saying it's DNA, because DNA is the seed level for all the different body parts. But as science is discovering, that seed level, when a fetus is, the sperm and the egg come together, the first cells are stem cells, and they will then differentiate into different parts of the body. So in order to heal anything that has been caused to be not well, and those causes are always spiritual actions, maybe in this lifetime and maybe in previous lifetimes, you need to take your body cells, body parts, back to their stem cell state so they can be restructured and rejuvenated. Now, how long does that process take? It's instantaneous. There's just one problem. You didn't change yourself. And so you took your body part in your consciousness back to the stem cell state where they are cleansed and rejuvenated, and you brought them back into the body, and then they're still in the dirt of the body. They're still in the dirt of the same character traits that you haven't eliminated. So how long does it take? It's instantaneously. But how can you prove it? It's like when you go into the mikveh and you immerse yourself under the water, you're at the level of consciousness. The whole body is in bina consciousness. And as soon as you exit that water, if you've changed yourself, then you're in the world that is coming. The Olam Haba. But most people, one, don't realize that. They don't have the understanding of what the mikveh represents, that it's bina, and that they're going through the rejuvenation process. But again, it always depends. Do you still have those character traits that created the body part that isn't working properly? So in order to use Yud Kaf Shin, you really have to know why is that body part not well. Now the consciousness in when we're saying the Anabakoa, it's any body part that needs healing. So many times we, you know, if I know I have a pain, I know there's something wrong. But I may not know that my kidney is deteriorating, God forbid. So I have to, by using the Yud Kaf Shin, I may have repaired it, rejuvenated it, and as I have to truly learn why it became unwell in the first place, so I can do teshuvah and change the actions that caused that. And that takes a level of consciousness, and the teachings of the Sefer Yetzirah, the way my teacher taught me and the way I teach my students, how to achieve that level of consciousness. But it's one thing to read the handouts for the classes of the Sefer Yetzirah, and it's another to do the actual spiritual work to cleanse yourself and to grow spiritually, to reveal more of your unconscious and heal the body parts. How long does that take? When the Midrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu was 120 years old, he had the stamina of a 25-year-old. When you look at the people in today's world, the rabbis in today's world, and the general population in today's world, we are told that we are a weak generation. We have lost this knowledge, this understanding, that anything that is wrong with me physically, I caused. And as I teach in some of my basic classes, and everybody laughs at me, and that's okay, I'm going to live at least 300 more years because it's going to take me that long to get rid of all of those bad character traits I have. So I hope I've answered your question and it's clear.
Well, I think the process is clear, but how to get there, it's a big jumble.
No, how to get there is very simple.
How do you identify all your problems?
This first step is that anything you see in somebody else means it's in you. So when you
but
see
just because
somebody,
you see that, it still doesn't if you got there, it doesn't necessarily mean you know how to undo it.
Well, that's where a spiritual healer comes in. That's where a spiritual teacher comes in. If you see something you don't like in a person, you see, and I'm being facetious, not really facetious, but as an example, you see somebody steal a piece of candy. It means that there is the element of theft in you. Now, how do you get rid of that? You have to find out the root source, the physical action that you did that is stealing, that is within you, that somewhat has been eliminated over the lifetimes. But you could still go back to that initial action and eliminate it. Do teshuvah for that and remove it. How do you find out what that is? How do you see that? I have had many students along these same lines. A woman came to me as a student. And when she was 18, she saw the world very simply, and she knew that she didn't want to have children. And she got pregnant, so she had an abortion. And for the 10 years after that, she would have dreams of a child. And then she got married, and her worldview had changed from, I'm not going to have children, to I want to have children. But she couldn't get pregnant. She came to me for help. We discussed the actions that took place. And I asked her, what is the seed level of your abortion? Is it the idea that you didn't want to have children? Or was it when you were put on the operating table? Or when you told the father of that child that you were having an abortion? What is the seed level for you? And once that was determined, and you can ask dream questions to get those answers, once that action is determined, you can read the basic classes and the advanced classes on Teshuvah, and the steps are very simple. Make amends. Confess your mistakes and meditate so that you change the action consciously. And when you change it consciously, it changes it physically. And if you read the basic class on Teshuvah, it's explained, or really the basic class, I think that this is in the binding by striking aspect, but it Teshuvah is related to binding by striking. The idea that you, if somebody is killed, if you shot somebody, God forbid, and that person died, how do you, you know, and you cause now the 12 children to become orphans and not be able to go to college and to have a much less life than if their father had lived, how do you fix that? Because the man is dead. But if you do teshuvah according to Kabbalah, then the widow is going to marry somebody that's a lot wealthier, put all of the kids through college, make their lives much simpler, give them all the tools to be successful in the society that they live. And therefore, their life is better than if their father had lived. That's what Kabbalah teaches. But what's the process? The process is simple. It's just never easy to do. And that's the real understanding. And I joke about it, but it's very, very real. If it was going to be easy, they'd have somebody else do it. No one is in this world with an easy path. But my path is hard for me. But if you're looking at my path, you might say, well, that's not difficult at all. But the truth is, for me, it's very difficult. And your path for you is very difficult. But I may see your path as very easy to do. But the truth is, your path is not my path. I have to do my own spiritual work. So it's always simple. It's just never easy to do. I hope it's clear.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I have one. On Shabbat, when we did that first two steps cut to the Satan for his due, do we also do that on the Shabbat during Passover with the matzah?
Yes.
Okay.
To clarify the question, because not everybody may understand it, and especially not everybody who listens to the recording. What Hannah was asking was, when you say the blessing over the challah, or on Passover over the matzah, the first bit, the first piece, is given to Satan so that he won't bother us. It's given to Satan because Satan is a very reactive entity. And so if he is given something, he accepts that as his due, and he doesn't come after you, like the Zohar says happened to Job. When God said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" All of Job's troubles came, according to what the Zohar says, all of those troubles that came to Job that he couldn't understand, all of it came because he never gave Satan any part of his sacrifice. He owed all of his sacrifices that he burned on his altars. All of those were olas. They were burnt offerings, which leaves nothing for anybody but what goes to Hashem. And so Satan, after many lifetimes, all of that was taken by Satan. And so we, knowing that Lechem, what it represents spiritually, we give him the first piece so that he won't bother us for anything else. And that applies to matzah on Passover as well as to Lechem or challah on Shabbat. And there's some discussion whether it's also during the mundane days of the week. And we've had those discussions. Any other questions?
When you're saying that, that you're acknowledging him, you're acknowledging that Hashem, that he's Hashem's servant, and you're giving him something. He's not power on his own, right?
Say this again. I didn't hear the last part.
He's not the power on his own. He's the servant of Hashem, right?
Correct.
So you're just feeding another Hashem's servant. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Because he's more than, he's Hashem's servant. But the task that that Satan has been given by Hashem has multi levels. He is the inciter, meaning he will present you with an opportunity to sin. And then he is the prosecutor in that judgment, that court judgment, where he reports, this is the sin you did. And he prosecutes, meaning he makes a recommendation to Hashem, this is the consequence of this is Satan's recommended consequence for the sin that you did, that he incited you to do. That is the task that he has been given, to test us. And then if we fail that test, or if we pass that test, he takes us to the court to have the consequence established by the court. Now, Satan always presents harsh judgment as the consequence. Hashem and the court and the members of that Bet Din, that court, will inject mercy. They will sweeten the judgments. But by giving the small piece of bread, we are saying, don't take us up, you know, don't come back and test us all the time. And if we, you know, we know that's your job, but we also need to know that part of what human beings have to do is to maintain the energy of the negative system, but not too much energy that they become overly strong. As we are taught, after Mashiach, there will still be Satan. It doesn't say that Satan will be destroyed. It says death will be swallowed up forever. And the metaphor that the Kabbalists have given us, walk into a lighted room and turn the switch off so it gets dark. Where did the darkness come from? It was light in the room before that. Where did the darkness come from? Conversely, if it's the dark room you walk into and you turn on the light, where did the darkness go? And we know it didn't disappear, because when you turn the light off, it comes back. So we know after Mashiach, Satan will still be here. He won't be exactly the same as he is in this world of Tikkun. He will be a less onerous to us entity. But he still has a purpose. He was created for that purpose. And by sharing the lechem, or the matzah, we are following through with Hashem's servant. We are giving him his due, always knowing that he is a servant of Hashem, and that we really are. Hashem has said to us, feed him this energy. And the Zohar explains that the mistake that Job did was to never give him his due. I know it can be confusing, but again, it's really simple. It's just not easy to do. It's not easy to understand. But it's easy to make connection through your intuition that what I'm saying to you is true. Not because I say it, but because it's in the Torah and in the soul of the Torah that we call the Zohar. But even that statement, for most people, when we say Torah, we're not talking about a living thing for most people, God forbid. But for the Kabbalist, when you say the word Torah, you're talking about a living energy, a servant of Hashem. Maybe it's the consciousness of Hashem, as we've learned from the word Anochi. But it is not a scroll in the physical world. It's an energy. It's an energy of righteousness. It's an energy that if we follow its paths, we will do the right actions at the right time with the right consciousness in the right location. But for most of the world, when you say the word Torah, they don't see that. And you can begin to see the power of Satan when he's been fed energy that it isn't his due because of our mistakes. And he receives the energy that we should have gotten, and he got. You see how powerful he comes. Because 300-400 years ago, people started to think, well, the Torah, that's just different people, and yes, very high souls, but different people writing different things that were all put together into one scroll by somebody somewhere. Now, is that true? For me, it's not, but for some, it is. Are they wrong? Always remember, they are creations of Hashem as well as me. And my truth and their truth are both valid. Ultimately, we will resolve that. We will argue through the machlokets to find an ultimate truth, and that means we will have grown spiritually. But if I say I'm right and they're wrong, what am I really doing? If I say I'm right and the other person is wrong, I'm using coercion. And that's not a path that is in the Torah. Are there any other questions? Or have I totally upset everybody?
Not at all.
The Torah does tell us specific things to do and not to do, though.
Does it?
Yeah.
What does it say not to do?
Don't kill. Don't steal. Don't.
And yet, for every mitzvah that you are not supposed to do, there are circumstances and situations where you are supposed to do it. True or false?
But you're saying that
true.
But you're saying that there's no right and wrong. So if somebody says that this is all the Torah was given by Hashem, and another person says that it was, you know, given by certain people, there's no right and wrong.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying the Torah is not about right and wrong. The Torah is not about morals and ethics. The Torah is about energy and energy conservation and energy transfers. People have put a morality into the Torah. They have read it that way. The Kabbalists do not read it that way. The Kabbalists see when it says, do not murder, that the light that is revealed by that action is going to the negative system. So they recommend strongly you don't do that. Not because you shouldn't murder, because there is a time when you need to murder somebody. If they're coming to murder you, you have to stand up and defend yourself. So every mitzvah, there is a time when you, if it says do not do it, there's a time to do it. And if it says do this mitzvah, there is a time or a circumstance where you need to not do it. But how do you know where that is? That's part of this Torah study. But all of that is not about morals. It's not about ethics. It's not about right and wrong. It's about energy transfer and energy conservation. And when I say energy, I'm talking about metaphysical energy. But on some level, it's also physical energy. And I know that what I'm saying is not the way people have been taught. And it's very difficult to make that transition. And just because I say it doesn't mean that it's right for you. You have to arrive at your own truth. What is right for you? And eventually, we will all come to understand it. And we will all come to arrive at what is the right thing to do at the right time, at the right place, with the right consciousness, the right kavanah. But just the most extreme example is the culture of ISIS. If you're an infidel, according to their definitions, you're supposed to have your head cut off, God forbid. And all of the Western world will rise up and say they're wrong. But the Kabbalists will never say that. The Kabbalists will say, if you're coming for my head, I'm going to defend myself. But your culture is your culture, and that is your culture for a reason. And Hashem created you, and Hashem allowed your culture to exist for a purpose. I may not know what that purpose is. I may not be able to see that purpose. But I have no right to take your life, except if you're trying to take mine.
Hello?
And that's very difficult. Go ahead.
Okay, as an example, I know, if I'm understanding you correctly, that decisions that are often made are made in reference to what we're experiencing at that time. But if someone makes a decision, and that decision has, will end in, collateral damage to another group of individuals, don't you have the right to defend yourself in that situation? The individual, say you have a business and they're making a decision
that is maybe what I would consider not a, an honest or truthful decision, but they're doing it, say, to because they want to survive. But the decision that they make is not an honest decision, and it has that will have damaging, very damaging repercussions for another group. Do you have the right to defend yourself in that type of situation?
Are you part of the other group?
I would be part of the group that, that suffered, yes.
Then you have the right to defend yourself. But if you listen to your question closely, you were not explaining yourself. Let's use as an example the chemical warfare that took place. The people who died, whoever was the cause of that bomb being dropped, and there may have been 7,000 human beings in that link of the process of that bomb being created and dropped. But whoever was caused, whoever was part of that process, has tremendous, I'm not going to say karma, it has tremendous debts to the people who were killed. But none of those people who were killed died as collateral damage. Every one of those people who were killed was authorized by the Bet Din, the spiritual court, that it was time for them to die, and they needed to die in that manner to cleanse what they had done in previous lifetimes. So were those 7,000 people who created that bomb wrong? Or were they tools of Hashem? Were they creatures of Hashem doing Hashem's service? Now, most people, when I would make that statement, say, I'm absolutely wrong. But this is what the Kabbalah teaches. Nobody dies unless the spiritual court has authorized them to die. And the people who caused them to die are acting as tools of Hashem, the hands of Hashem, to cause that to happen.
Okay. But the person, okay, that person or individual that caused that group of 7,000 people to be killed, are you saying that?
No, the 7,000 people caused others to be killed. They created a bomb that killed other people. The people who were killed had had a spiritual court authorize their death in that manner. Now, did those 7,000 people need to be the manner, need to be the agents of the death of the people who died? That's the question that we have to ask and get answered.
And that's what I'm asking you.
And what is the question?
The question is, the agents who created the death, is this a cycle that continues on and on and on and on? Does it ever stop?
Yes, it stops when you love the other person. You can't kill somebody you love. That's what V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha means. Love your neighbor as yourself. So those 7,000 people drop a bomb on me. I cannot die unless the court authorized me to die. God forbid. Do I have the certainty that I can live through the bomb? I'm not at that spiritual level, but there are people in this world who are. Where are they? They're not going to reveal themselves to the likes of me. Learning the spiritual system, learning how the world works at the spiritual level, is what helps you come to this understanding. How can you love your neighbor as yourself? We don't even love ourselves. How can we love another? I don't want to go down that path because it'll take, 22,000 hours. But those 7,000 people who were agents of building that bomb, they have the effect of those actions. It's going to come back to them. And how do you get out of that? Is to elevate your consciousness so that you see every person in this world as a spark of Hashem, as part of the light of Hashem. That Hashem created that person, and that person has truth that's relative to them, that's correct for them. And when you see that, you cannot hold a grudge. You cannot seek revenge. You can just see them as being the hands of Hashem causing the death of these people in this way. If that's not true, then Hashem will have a spiritual court that will have them prosecuted and will have their judgment. But if I see it as they are the hands of Hashem, I cannot be wrong relative to me, because that's part of a process of learning to love my neighbor as myself.
Who is this court then?
Say again, you broke up.
Who is this spiritual court that judges the soul?
The spiritual court is just like there's a physical Sanhedrin consisting of 70 judges, and for capital cases, it takes 23. There are 23 people who have died, who are righteous, who are tzaddikim, who sit on that court. And the prosecutor is Satan, and the defendant is the person being judged. And it happens every night to every human being for the actions they did that day. And it happens every Rosh Hashanah for what's going to happen to that person in the coming year. And it happens at the end of someone's life when they leave the world. That's their final court. And it's determined whether they reincarnate, whether they go to Kehinom to be cleansed, or they go into different other locations wherever they have to go for their tikkun.
I have another question.
That happens all the time.
If you say to us that our highest goal is ve'ahavta to l'riyacha kamocha, so that if we reach that level, we don't have any judgment on another person. So presumably, these spiritual judges are on that level. How is it they have any judgment?
Because their judgment is what it will be the best for this person that we're judging to be the most efficient way they will reach their tikkun. What life experiences do they need to see tomorrow so that they will reach their highest tikkun? They will achieve their tikkun. That's the premise of these 23 righteous judges. But usually it's just a court of three. what you do every day, it's a court of three. And their attitude is, look what you did today. What will you experience tomorrow that will move you forward to achieve your tikkun?
So that sounds more like a person. I heard that when you get to Shemayim, the only one that can judge you is yourself, and nobody's allowed to judge you.
No one's allowed to judge you in this world. But people judge other people, do they not? Because we haven't
When the soul goes to Shemayim, the only one that's judging them is himself.
The only one who is a witness is themselves. Their own soul is a witness to the motivations, the consciousness of the action. It's not a question of judging. Those three righteous souls are making the ultimate judge, but the judgment is the Satan presents a plan which is called a judgment. The plan is what will motivate this person to achieve his tikkun tomorrow when he comes back into the world and he experiences his life. What actions, what will he experience that will cause him to achieve more of his tikkun? But that plan that Satan presented was based on the witness of that soul expressing and judging himself and explaining what he did and why he did it. Now that Satan brings this plan, and the judges say, yeah, that's a good plan, go ahead and do it. Or the judges say, no, that needs to have some modifications, it's too harsh. Let's sweeten it in these ways. If you've ever seen, and this is going to be hopefully not too confusing, but if you've ever seen the near-death experience videos of various people, what a Jewish person who has a near-death experience, he sees one perception. A Hindu who has a near-death experience sees another because he's seeing what he expects to see. A Christian sees something else. A Muslim something else. Every person's expectation of what they expect to see is what they will see. But ultimately, what is the right thing, quote unquote, whatever right means? What is their truth? The soul judges itself. The soul is a witness for and against its own action. So what you learned is correct, but your understanding of it is not correct. Because what the spiritual court is doing is saying, what do I have to do to motivate this soul to become stronger and take over its body and motivate the body to do righteous actions? That's why the soul is put into the body, so that the two together will find a way to merge. And that's the whole idea. That's one of the understandings of love your neighbor as yourself. Who is your neighbor? Your neighbor is the soul. Your neighbor is the body. Your neighbor is Hashem. Your neighbor is the guy next door. These are all different levels.
So, Hanak, in the event that
injustice has been committed on this
earthly plane. What injustice? Define injustice.
Injustice is any action that caused harm to an individual or a group of people. For instance,
that is not the definition of injustice in a different culture.
In a different culture, but you're asking me how I'm perceiving or injustice.
I'm not asking you. You're asking me. And you're saying if somebody does injustice based on my society's values, okay? If somebody does injustice based on my society's values, then my society has punishment. They have jails. They have death sentences. They have all of these different forms of punishment. Hashem has... Wait a second. Oh, if that's not your question, then I'll stop and let you ask the question differently.
Okay. You're right up to a point. If based on my definition of injustice, my question was going to be, you see this injustice, you know that it's happened. Are we to ignore that it's happening in terms of a sentence being given on our level, or do we wait for the spiritual system to... to exact justice or judgment?
And the answer to that question is each individual has to make that decision for themselves. When you realize that the society's values that you're basing injustice on is not the spiritual system's basis for injustice, when you understand that, then your values and your attitude toward the consequences of injustice changes. What is injustice in the spiritual system? When somebody doesn't do an action, or injustice in the spiritual system, and I'm making this up, could be that the person's action is lengthening their tikkun process, which means they're lengthening the tikkun process of every other human being. That's injustice according to the spiritual level, as I understand it at this moment. And that's very different than the idea of injustice in the Western world, the Western society that I live in, that I have absorbed since childhood, and that the Kabbalah is giving me the tools to overcome that misperception.
Makes it complicated because if you're saying that what a person is going through is part of his tikkun, and what to us would appear to be unjust, how do we have a justice system and like try to prevent abuse and things like that? Why? What then is the motivation to try to prevent abuse? If you're saying, well, what happened to this person?
The motivation to prevent abuse is that the person who creates the abuse, who acts and does the abuse, they are lengthening their tikkun. And since they're lengthening their tikkun, it means that the rest of humanity, all 7.5 billion people, have to wait on that longer period of time And that's injustice. Why should I have to wait because this guy made a mistake? So I work within the society to help that person understand and not make that mistake again. And I help him learn through the study of Kabbalah to do teshuvah so that he can actually reverse that abuse. Our hour is up. Unless somebody has another question, we are not going to settle this in this hour.
No.
This is the life. That's why Kabbalah is a lifetime study.
Yeah.
You've had a lifetime to learn the Western world's values, and Kabbalah comes along and says there's a higher value called the spiritual world. Now start to try and see what is the spiritual value. And the spiritual value is the shortest path to the endless world.
Excuse me.
Shalom to all.
Shalom. Thank you so much.